This week's interview is with David Gehlke. He writes for Dead Rhetoric and also writes for Blabbermouth.net, and he is the author of a new book entitled Damn the Machine, The Story of Noise Records. And David, talk about your new book. Tell everybody what it's about and give everybody an overview of the book that's coming out here in the next month or so.
Yeah, the book is called Damn the Machine, The Story of Noise Records. As the title suggests, it is about the German record company Noise Records that was around in the 80s and 90s and up until 2001, at least in its first incarnation when Karl Ulrich Walterbach was running it. And it captures basically Karl's journey, if you want to put it that way, coming up through the Berlin punk rock scene up until when he formed Noise in 1983. Then it details, you know, all the bands he signed, like Hellhammer, and Hellhammer became Celtic Frost, and Halloween, and Gravedigger, Running Wild, the whole bit. And the goal of the book is to capture Karl's side, take you through his experiences in the music industry. Then, of course, interview the bands who interacted with Karl on a daily basis. And Noise had such a wide array of bands and so many bands throughout the years, we were able to put together a pretty long and detailed story. So I think we ended up at about 504 pages total. But yeah, it's really for anyone who is interested in the music industry, as well as even just the bands, people who are fans of Creator and Gravedigger and Corner and Sabbath, Skyclad, Halloween, down the line, and sort of a multifaceted book in that regard. So yeah, it turned out pretty well.
David, what inspired you to write this book? I think this book is very well done. It's very detailed. You had to do a lot of work to get all the information from so many different bands on the label. And talk about what inspired you to write this book to begin with.
What inspired me really was, and it all goes back to Tom G. Warrior's first book, which is called Are You Morbid? Into the Pandemonium of Celtic Frost, which is about his career in Celtic Frost. And it details, of course, them making all their great albums, but the flip side to it is they had a very terrible time in the music industry, particularly with Noise. And Karl Ulrich Walterbach is painted as the villain throughout this book, and Tom does not go very easy on him. And based on that, that sort of piqued my interest. You know, what is the deal with this guy, as in Karl, that is? Was he really all that bad? Was he really treating his bands this way? And then I think around 2013, Karl had reemerged as a band manager, and some of his bands had started getting coverage in the metal press, and you'd see Karl's name attached to it. And so I sent Karl a very casual email saying, hey, I love Noise stuff. I'm a big fan of your label, and I listed all the bands, and I asked him, would you be up for an interview? And sure enough, we scheduled an interview, I think, about a week later, and he and I spoke for probably about an hour or 2 hours. I mean, that's the great thing about Karl. Karl is just a fantastic person to talk to. He has just one regular train of thought, basically, and he always has some type of insight or angle on things that you wouldn't expect. And so when you talk to Karl, I started to think, well, he'd be a great foundation for a book. You know, this guy has tons of stories. No one's really heard his side of things. You know, we've always heard from the bands that were on Noise that they weren't treated very well. So let's get Karl's side of the story. And then as it turns out, Karl has this great backstory of growing up as a squatter in Berlin, coming up through the 70s, then he got into punk rock, and the Berlin punk rock scene was pretty intense and violent, and, you know, once that sort of ran out for Karl, he discovered metal, and he was just at the right place at the right time in 1983 to start Noise, and so that's really where it started. You know, there haven't been a whole lot of books on record companies either. You know, you think about all the great record companies that have come through, like Roadrunner, or Metal Blade, or Megaforce, things like that. There aren't really any books on them. And it sort of seemed if you take, you know, the backstory of Karl and all the incidents he's had with his bands, his life, it all made perfectly good sense to put together a book. And so I actually had to talk Karl into doing the book when I first proposed it to him. He turned me down a couple of times. Then I had put together a proposal. I told him how I'd like to do it. And he eventually agreed to it. You know, he agreed that, you know, we'll get Karl's side unfiltered, if you will, no holds barred, and we get his bands as well. And we started on the book, I want to say, in March of 2014, and it took about 2.5 years to write. So, yeah, like you were saying, Tony, there was a lot of interviews. I think I interviewed over 75 people for the book, not counting Karl. Karl and I talked every Sunday for over 2 years, every Sunday at 10 a.m., which would make it about 4 p.m. Berlin time. And yeah, just a lot of work. And so, once I had the idea in my head and I was able to talk Carl into it and get bands on board, it sort of started rolling from there.
Now, my question for you is, has Carl read the book, and have any of the bands read the book, or, you know, is everybody going to get a nice big surprise when this book finally comes out to see what's been written about them and you know, things like that?
Yeah, Carl has read his quotes for the book. So we had an agreement at the very early going that, you know, if Carl were to participate in this book, he would be allowed to see the quotes of his that we were using. And so you mentioned transcribing interviews. Well, yeah, I transcribed all my interviews with Carl, and I extracted his quotes, and I shared them with him and said, okay, Carl, this is yours. This is what we're going to be using of yours. Feel free to elaborate. Here's the context of it all. If you want to change something, by all means, they're your words. So Carl has seen the chapter outline and I guess the main gist of the book. So yes, he is aware of its contents and everything that's in it. It's still pretty early for some of the bands to have read it. There are several who we've already reached out to and will be getting a copy. So I don't think anything will be much of a surprise to these guys. I think they're all quoted fairly accurately. They may be surprised at what Carl said about them, or maybe they won't, actually. You know, I think maybe some of that is ancient history. But nevertheless, once we get closer to the release date of March 24th, we will be sending some copies to the bands. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you know, Noise Records was basically like the Metal Blade of Europe back in the day. You know, Metal Blade Records was an independent label that really made a huge impact on heavy metal here in the USA, and Noise Records was like the European equivalent of that. And you know, you read some of these great quotes from Carl about some of these bands, you know, in interviews from the past, but you know, it had to be difficult because, you know, everybody in the 80s, the labels and the bands always fought over money and, you know, who did this and who did that and who ripped me off and who didn't rip me off. And was it difficult for you to go and paint both sides of the story without really trying to sound biased for either side? And, you know, was it very difficult for you to try to put quotes and put things in a context so, you know... people aren't going to get all angry at each other.
Yeah, well, it was very hard, and there were some things that some bands said and some things that Carl said that we simply could not use because it would be for legal reasons, obviously not a prudent decision on our part. But if you read the interviews from people like Tom G. Ward, who is just absolutely brutal on Carl, if you think about the album Cold Lake, which of course is their main career blunder that happened in 1988 when they decided to go hair metal, you know, Tom does say, well, Cold Lake never wouldn't have happened if it weren't for Noise Records. Tom is alluding to the fact that their relationship with the label was so bad and they were so poor and they were treated so poorly that they never would have had such a change in direction. But yeah, there were absolutely some very hard feelings across the board from a lot of these bands. If you think about Gravedigger, of course, you know, we think of the Digger album, you know, when they went from Gravedigger to Digger, mm-hmm. You know, there's sort of the back and forth there. You know, who's responsible? Was Carl responsible? Was Gravedigger responsible? And the middleman in all this was Gravedigger's manager, whose name is Gert Hanke. And he depicts it as really it was the band's decision. It wasn't so much as Carl's decision. So, you know, there's one instance of thing. You know, Creator weren't treated very well, but if you talk to a guy like Milla now, he has what he calls the PMA, the positive mental attitude. And so I don't think he was really into going too deep about the bad things that happened to the band during their time with Noise. But yeah, I mean, you know, still after all these years, after 20, 30 some odd years, there are a lot of hard feelings that existed. And so how I approached it was, you know, like we were talking about earlier, you have Carl's side. So there's one side, then you have the bands, and it's really up to the reader to decide who was treated fair or who was treated well. As the author of the book, the motto I stuck to was just play it down the middle. And so unless there was something that was blatantly obviously like something that Carl did that was pretty obvious that was wrong or something the band did that was wrong, you know, outside of that, I played it down the middle. I tried not to take a side and would leave it up to the reader to decide. Because, you know, as you mentioned, you know, there's always two sides, there's three sides to the story. Think about it, you know. So just trying to navigate through that was definitely one of the hardest things in the book, in addition to actually getting some bands to talk. You know, there were a lot of emails exchanged, a lot of publicists involved, a lot of managers. You know, when you say the word Noise Records book, they think, okay, this is a Carl Walterbach project. Well, no, it was you know, was written by me. I was the only guy writing it. And so once fans got around on that idea and they were able to speak candidly on record, we didn't have much problem conducting interviews.
Was it difficult to get anybody to comment on anything? I mean, was it really hard to get some of these bands to want to do this? And at the same time, were there any bands that just flat out refused that said, I don't want to say anything and I want no part of this?
There were a few. Let me think. The one that comes to mind that we really wanted to get, and this is sort of later in the era of noise, was a band called Manhole, who were fronted by Terry B. Mm-hmm. And she was a rapper come turn of the 90s. She worked with it would be the Ruthless folks, actually. So Eric Eve Wright, she was one of his proteges. And then once the mid-90s rolled around, she had started a new metal band. And by that time, Carl was living in California. He was tired of melodic metal. He was looking for the next big thing. And he wanted to sign Korn. He wanted to sign Snot. He wanted to sign System of a Down. He struck out on all of those. So he settled for Manhole. And as we depict in the book, Carl and Terry B did not have a very good relationship. It seemed it was almost strained from the beginning. And we asked Terry to go on record and be interviewed, and she turned us down. So she was really the main one that we weren't able to get. And if we want to go outside of bands, we actually did approach Sanctuary. We did approach Rod Smallwood, but he turned us down as well. I think the reasoning was he only talks about Iron Maiden related mm-hmm. activities. So if we were to talk to Smallwood, it would have been about Helloween, his dealings with Carl, the court case, EMI, and then later, of course, when Sanctuary Music bought Noise, we would have talked about that. So those are really the two ones that we missed out on. Everyone else, thankfully, we were able to get.
Well, so let's talk about Carl for a little bit, because you don't see Carl say very much in public. He doesn't really do a lot of interviews anywhere. And, you know, what was it like for you to talk to Carl? What kind of person is he? And, you know, talk about your dealings with him.
Yeah, Carl, what can you say about him? He is very candid. No holds barred is a thing. He will tell you it was something or someone, or if he has an opinion on something, he is not afraid to say it. He's sort of this anti-authority through Berlin in the 70s and the squatters movement. So, you know, punk rock and anti-establishment, anarchy. Anarchist, too, something he's gone on record saying many, many times. And, you know, there's a certain, you almost admire something. Doesn't go along with things as they are. So, I mean, he's just a very complex individual. I think he found himself with Noise having more success than he anticipated. I mean, I don't think he saw the label blowing up like it did in the mid-80s. You know, if we talk about when Helloween got rolling and Celtic Frost was having success and Running Wild once they put out Under Jolly Roger. I mean, the label blew up, and by then, once 86, it was 1986 or 87, Carl just had too much work on his plate. Then he became the authority figure, which deep down, I think he didn't quite enjoy being. He was never one of the guys. You know, he was never friendly with any of his bands. He was never really friendly with anyone in the industry, and I think that was simply a product of how much work he had on his plate, and that, you know, he of course saw Noise as being something being successful, but it just blew up so fast. It was just a runaway train that he could not control. But, you know, you talk to Carl today, and he has a memory as sharp as a tack. A lot of things he was telling me about, yeah, they definitely did happen. He definitely has a dose of humility to him. He could admit when he made mistakes. There were some things in the book that he talked about that he did mess up on, particularly as the 80s turned into the 90s. You know, he was so occupied with the court case with EMI over Helloween and that he basically lost sight of the label's expenses. And the label had some financial trouble. Carl himself had some financial trouble. And he admitted, you know, if I could do it all over again, there were a lot of things I would have done differently. So, you know, some people see him as this villainous guy with no personality or no feelings whatsoever for his bands, but I tend to disagree with that. I think deep down he did care. He wanted his bands to be successful. He just never was that buddy-buddy label guy with anyone, and that's just not his personality. So, yeah, Carl's a complex person. I'm forever indebted to him for letting me do the book about his label. I mean, you can't write the story of Noise Records without Carl. And just working with him and getting to know him over the last 2 or 3 years has been a real pleasure. I'm very thankful that I got to know him.
So let's talk about some of the bands that you've had that you talked to. And, the first one I'm going to touch on is Gravedigger, because they were one of, if not the first signing for the label. And even though they weren't there that long, obviously there was a big chapter on them. And, I've dealt with Chris for many years. Chris is somebody that I've known for a long time, and I've always thought Chris is a great guy. And obviously, these years in noise aren't sometimes the best things to talk about with people on the label. So talk about Chris Boltendahl and the chapter you wrote about Gravedigger, and talk a bit about interviewing Chris.
Yeah, you're right. Gravedigger / Digger technically were on noise for only 4 years. I think they were let go sometime in the middle of 1987 when Carl. The sales of Digger's album, Stronger Than Ever, were so poor that Carl said, "There's no way I'll ever work with you guys again." Then they broke up, and they reformed, and subsequently, 5 or 6 years later, and were signed by Gunn. So, yeah, Chris, you think of Gravedigger now, you really don't. They're forever known for heavy metal breakdown, but their more recent albums are really strong as well. But Chris, they were really that second wave of German metal bands. You have the first wave, which is really Accept and the Scorpions. Well, who's right behind them? It's Gravedigger. And they were sort of trailblazers in a sense. They weren't a thrash band. They weren't a power metal band. They were sort of like this raw and raucous metal band. Because Chris, he's not a singer, as we all know. He sort of has his own throaty delivery that no one else really has.
Right.
They had some faster songs, but they were really anthemic and catchy and easy to get into. But the thing with Gravedigger was that Chris had very poor English when they first started, and his grasp of English was so poor that their manager, Gert Henke, had to help them out with lyrics. And so, sort of that charm is in there. If you listen to their lyrics, they're not precise English. They're sort of the slurred English. And they only knew how to write about a few things, which was, heavy metal and war and, very typical topics of the time. But, Chris, to this day, I think, is not very fond of Carl. And that's just based on what happened with Digger. It was mentioned that Chris's one of his heroes was David Lee Roth, and he wanted to be like him. Well, you could make the argument that both of them are—they're not really singers, So I guess you could emulate David Lee Roth in that sense. And they were after War Games; they were sort of stuck in that middle. They weren't as big as Helloween or Running Wild, and they were looking to get to the next level. And they tried doing this soft hard rock album, and it blew up in their faces. And I think Chris holds a lot of resentment towards Carl about this, suggesting that it was Carl's idea that they try this. But in reality, Carl hated that stuff. Carl hated stadium rock. He hated hair metal. He hated all that stuff. It would probably be very unlikely that Carl would suggest any of his bands, especially someone like Gravedigger, to go that route. So Gravedigger's career, you have this short chunk up until 87, but then from 1993 onward, they've been as consistent as any German metal band.
Now I'm going to backtrack to the beginning of the book, because you had Hansi Kirsch from Blind Guardian give the foreword in the beginning of the book, and why did you pick Hansi to do this?
There were two choices for the foreword. One was Hansi, and the other was Toby Sammet of Avantasia and Ed Guy. What we were looking for was sort of that next generation of German metal bands that would have come right after Helloween. Although Blind Guardian started, with Lucifer's Heritage, they started, around 84, 85. So technically they're about as old as Helloween, if you think about it. But they really didn't become the prominence until the late 80s, early 90s, when they signed to Virgin. But I wanted someone that wasn't on noise, but I knew that Carl had wanted. Carl really wanted Blind Guardian quite badly at the turn of the 90s. And for whatever reasons, they decided to go with Virgin. And obviously we saw how that works out. That worked out quite well. But, anytime you have a forward, you want someone who's very respectable and a big name. And there are a few bigger names than Blind Guardian in European metal. And Hansi, of course, is one of the nicest guys, as you well know. I mean, you've interviewed him before. Mm-hmm. He's just one of the nicest, most easygoing guys you ever want to meet. And seriously, it was just a simple, I was actually conducting a regular interview with him for Blind Guardian's most recent album 2 years ago. And it was a simple question. Hey, I'm writing a book about Noise Records. I know there's at least some involvement there. Would you be interested in writing the foreword? And he said, yeah, without hesitation. And, you know, it's one of those things you almost fall out of your chair. You know, you don't think Hanzi from Blind Guardian would be writing the book's foreword, and sure enough, agreed to do it. And what he put together was just perfect, a great way to start off the book.
Well, we talked a little bit about some of the negatives. You know, you talked about Time Warrior and some of the negative things that many of the bands have said. However, on a more positive note, Rock and Rolf and Carl got along really well. In fact, Running Wild was one of those bands that really, you know, hasn't gone out and said anything bad about the label. You know, Rolf and Carl got along really well. And Running Wild was a band that did well on Noise for the most part. And talk about that. Talk about Rolf and the relationship that he had with Carl and what they had to say about each other.
Yeah, well, Running Wild is the personification of a Noise band. If you think about it, Carl never wanted his band to change their sound. Carl would have been perfectly happy with all of his bands making, I don't want to say the same record over and over again, but staying in the same style. You make slight adjustments over time, but you, for lack of a better term, you stay in your lane. But at the same time, you have to have an image. And Running Wild, when they started, they were your typical guys wearing black leather and studs and bullet belts. They really didn't have much. And, you know, a lot of people forget they had sort of a quasi-satanic angle as well. You know, it wasn't really that serious. It wasn't as overtop as Venom, but it was certainly there. And, you know, when they had their tour with the Voivod and Celtic Frost in 1986 here in America, and they were booed off stage and blown off the stage every night, and they were told to go home after X amount of dates into the tour, you know, Rolf had the foresight to think, okay, what can we do different to separate ourselves? And sure enough, you know, he had seen Roman Polanski's Pirates movie with Walter Matthau, and, you know, the first pirate metal band is born. And, yeah, Carl had always hoped that Running Wild, you know, pirates, if you think about pirates or buccaneers, they're not jolly characters. They're not nice guys who are smiling and missing teeth. I mean, they are, you know, villainous people who will take your ship and take all your belongings. And Carl had always secretly wished they would have become a little bit more menacing. But, you know, Running Wild for a while with their pirate looks, you know, they had this great, very bright and lively angle. And, of course, everyone in Europe took to it immediately. And, you know, once Jolly Roger happened, I mean, the band blew up over in mainland Europe, and Carl couldn't have been happier. There were very few times that they had some dust-ups. So they had a great relationship, those two. Very easygoing, very few conflicts. You know, what had happened when they left Noise in the mid-90s was they were managed by Bogey Kopech, who also had Creator and Rage at the time, and Bogey was starting his own label. They were backed by DMG, so there's a lot of money in it, and that's really when Noise hit their down period. And it just made a lot of sense for them to leave Noise and hopefully for greener pastures. But, you know, yeah, that was one of the most drama-free relationships, you know, with one of Carl's bigger bands. You know, he, to this day, I think there's a great amount of respect between the two men. I mean, Running Wild never, if you think about it, they've always been consistent. They've never done anything outlandish with their sound. The album they put out last year was simply fantastic. And, you know, that's just a lot of credit to Rolf. He knows what he wants. He knows how to write songs that certainly stick out. They have their own style, and really there's no other band like Running Wild.
One of the more interesting chapters in the book was the chapter on Rage. And, you know, I know you talked with PB quite extensively about his time with Noise Records. And let's talk about interviewing PB and talk about Rage and talk about what Carl had to say about him, because I thought of all the chapters in there, it was one of the more interesting parts of the book.
Rage was an interesting one because they've had a great career, obviously. They have a very impressive track record. But they weren't, their story wasn't deep enough to give them their own chapter, like a typical long chapter like Creator or Helloween or Celtic Frost had, but we couldn't leave them out. There was no way they could be left out of the book. So, you know, we slid sort of this mini chapter in, and PB and I conducted everything via email, but he was always fast to respond, very polite about things. He did say right off the bat, you know, I don't have good feelings towards Carl, just to let you know, but I'm going to tell you what happened. And, you know, sure enough, you know, when Rage got their start, when they changed their name from Avenger to Furious Rage, well, Carl didn't like that very much, and so he changed it simply to Rage. You know, PD walks into the record store thinking he's going to see, you know, the debut album from Furious Rage, and sure enough, it's just Rage. And so that's sort of where the spiral began with their relationship. But really, in earnest, Carl never saw Rage as a top-tier band. He always thought they were sort of in the middle, much like Corner, actually. He always lumped those two together. But, you know, Rage were a great melodic speed metal band. You know, a lot of people forget about how good Reign of Fear was, or a few of their other albums were pretty good. Perfect Man is another good one, too. But very, very underrated. What sort of bogged them down was, you know, Carl always mentioned they didn't have a standout image at the time, which could be true, you know. But great speed metal, great melodic speed metal band, and PV's a survivor in every sense of the word. I mean, they've been around for over 30 years now, and through several lineups and several ups and downs, and PV still keeps going. So you have to commend a guy like that, because, you know, when they were on Noise, they were definitely not a priority. Carl never saw them as a priority, but they stuck it out, and much like Running Wild and Creator, they went over to Gunn and were there for a few years, and then, you know, they moved over to SPV and a few other labels, and they're still around today.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the chapter that probably is going to be the most read part of the book, and that's a chapter about Helloween, because obviously, you know, they ended up getting their rise on Noise Records. There was the big court case. You know, there are still some members and former members of the band that still have a lot of animosity towards Carl, and I'm sure Carl probably has the same towards them. So let's talk about the Helloween chapter of the book and you know, what the bands had to say, what the band had to say, and what Carl had to say.
They were, Helloween was Carl's favorite band. I mean, Carl liked thrash and slash speed metal, which Helloween in some respects were, but, you know, they were really the first power metal band. And the fact that they, you know, when they did the initial mini album, the Helloween mini album, you know, Carl had minimal expectations. Walls of Jericho got going, you know, yeah, this, he was suitably impressed. But then once the Keeper albums started going and they got Kiss in the band, I think that really changed his perspective on them, and they became his favorite band. He loved Helloween. He loved Kai Hansen. He loved Kiske's voice. Never liked Michael Whitehead, which is noted throughout the book. I think Carl never quite understood Whitehead's songwriting angle, and as we know, you know, Whitehead doesn't write typical songs. He writes, you know, these unique songs. I mean, take a song like Dr. Steen. I mean, who else would come up with something like that? You know, only Michael Whitehead would. So, yeah, I mean, and of course, Carl loved Helloween because they were, you know, his high-selling band. You know, they were the first band to break six figures for Noise. He had them on RCA over here, you know, doing, you know, big digits as well. You know, when they did the single for Dr. Steen, you know, that broke the top 10. Carl was elated about that. So, you know, Helloween was the band that helped fund, you know, a lot of Carl's endeavors over the years. I mean, they helped him open up a U.S. office. In 1987, the UK office came shortly thereafter. You know, they enabled him to live comfortably, but also at the same time, he sunk a lot of his own money into the label. You know, he signed a lot of bands around that time. It's sort of that period between 87 and 89. That's when Carl was signing the most bands and seeing what would stick to the wall and what wouldn't. But, yeah, I mean, the whole Helloween thing is, you know, Carl was warned pretty early on that you need to be careful because these guys are so good that a larger management company or a major label will come in and try and take them away from you because you're just an independent record company. And sure enough, that's what happened come 1987. You know, Sanctuary Management with Rod Smallwood and Andy Taylor were already creeping around the band and were interested in taking them on. And then, you know, Helloween's manager, Lim Schnorr, was pushed out and Sanctuary became management, and they saw no use for Noise or Carl and worked to get them on over to EMI, and from that point on, Helloween was not Carl's favorite band after that, let's put it that way.
Right.
But yeah, just a really, really complicated relationship there.
Now, you mentioned that Carl and Michael Whitehead didn't get along. However, it was quite the opposite with Kai Hansen. In fact, he was very high on Kai Hansen and liked him quite a bit. And did that lead to, you know, Gamma Ray signing with Noise and being with Noise Records for as long as they were?
Yeah, well, there's this thing, and it has been disputed by Kai and a few other things, but it is an industry standard, the leading member clause. You know, if you are signed to a label and don't fulfill your contractual obligations, according to Carl, and this is what Noise had in their deals, you know, you are bound to Noise. So, you know, when Kai left Helloween in 1988, he spent that year in Hamburg, you know, taking music lessons or singing lessons and doing some studio work and helping Blind Guardian out, but you know, his next band, whether that was to be simply called Hanson, and eventually became Gamma Ray, obviously. Yeah, you know, that was to become Noise. But you know, Wyke made a side comment in the book that, you know, Kai's deal for Noise with Gamma Ray was far better to that than of Halloween's deal with Noise. So you know, I was never able to get confirmation on how good that deal was or not. Kai could remember, and I don't think Carl could either. But you know, that's just goes to show Carl always had a great deal of confidence in Kai. You know, Kai, much like Rolf Kasparek from Running Wild, was what Carl wanted in a musician. You know, a traditional heavy metal guy, knew how to write great songs, had a great understanding of melody, was a very hard worker, and, you know, was a very popular guy, of course. You know, once Kai left Halloween, he still maintained popularity. And so, you know, that's probably why Gamma Ray was able to stay with Noise for a while. And, you know, Kai was very loyal to Carl throughout the 90s. I mean, Gamma Ray could have left Noise in the mid-90s around Land of the Free. I mean, Land of the Free, they had fulfilled their contractual obligation. But they stuck with Noise up until Sanctuary came along. And, Carl and Kai, I don't think they don't have the same warm and cozy relationship to that of Rolf Kasparek and Carl, but I think there's a great mutual respect between the two.
Obviously, two of the people that have not been very fond of Noise Records is obviously Michael Wyckoff and, of course, the former singer Michael Kiske. And, you know, talk about interviewing both of them for the book.
Yeah, Kiske, like you had mentioned, he still harbors a lot of ill will towards Carl. There were some things we simply could not use that Michael said. There was a great quote that we were able to dig up from Metal Hammer in 1990 where Kiske says, you know, should Carl Walterbach win this court case? This is when Noise was in court against EMI Records over the rights to Halloween. You know, Kiske did say, you know, should Carl Walterbach win this case, Halloween will break up immediately. Well, we saw what happened. I mean, Noise did win the court case, but Halloween did not break up. But I think that goes to show, I mean, Kiske was the youngest guy in the band. It seemed, you know, he'd probably tell you this, that he took it a little bit more personally. You know, Halloween could have done so many great things, you know, had Kai stayed in the band, had maybe they stayed on Noise. You know, if they stay on Noise and Kai stays in the band, would Pink Bubbles Go Ape happen? Would Chameleon happen? Probably not. Carl certainly wouldn't have gone for any of the songs on Pink Bubbles Go Ape or Chameleon, that's for sure. And Kai, of course, probably wouldn't have been too into it as well. So, Kiske definitely took it personally there. Kai, as you had mentioned, there really wasn't as much hostility there. I think he was always looking over his shoulder based on, you know, what Carl had, the incidents Carl's had with some of his other bands. But it seemed like those two, they had a pretty compatible working relationship throughout Gamma Ray's time with Noise, mm-hmm. which they mainly consisted of the 90s.
So let's talk a little bit about Michael Wyckoff. I know you spoke to him. And, you know, my other question is, did you speak to Marcus at all? Because obviously he would have, you know, he was in the band when all this was going on. But, you know, talk about talking with Wyke and what he had to say about the whole situation.
Yeah, I didn't talk to Marcus for the book, but I did talk to Wyke, and much like you, Tony, I've known Wyke I definitely haven't known him as long as you, but I've known him for about 8 or 9 years now, and I think I've interviewed him at least 7 or 8 times, and I think that's where we developed our relationship. And we spoke for the Noise book for, I think, about 2.5 hours, and so, it was great. He is just one of the best interviews around. If you're looking for a good quote, you just go to Michael Wyckoff because he has such a unique perspective and angle on things. He doesn't think about things like most people would, and that certainly applies to, you know, their time with Noise. You know, Wyckoff did say, yeah, we were, for the most part, we were happy with Noise, but, you know, they weren't making any money, you know, for a band as popular as Halloween was circa 1988-89. You know, they weren't seeing any money, and sure enough, you know, Sanctuary saw that. It's like, okay, guys, could probably get you a better deal somewhere else. And, you know, Wyke was always looking, as you well know, looking to push the band further around that time. You know, he, I think by then he was sort of over power metal. You know, he had already done his great power metal song, which is Eagle Fly Free. You know, he'd already done his great commercial song, which is Dr. Steen, and, you know, Rise and Fall is great too. And he did his epic, which is Keeper of the Seven Keys, the song. He was looking to do something different, and I think Carl had already known that, and that's probably why he didn't trust Wyckoff as much as, say, Kai Hansen. And so, yeah, I mean, those two don't get along as well. You know, Carl blames Wyke for a lot of the bad things that happened to Helloween in terms of pink bubbles and them leaving EMI. So, yeah, there's still a great deal of hard feelings there. But, you know, it seems like Wyke has moved past it all. And that has a lot to do with the fact, you know, when Helloween was coming off of Chameleon, and it was really Wyke who steered them back to prominence, you know, once they got Darius in the band in 1994 and did Master of the Rings. That's sort of when they got on the straight and narrow. You could really, a lot of the credit goes to Wyke for that. And then based on the fact that he's been able to keep Helloween going for as long as he has, I don't think he is as bitter as other people are about his time on Noise.
So what do you think about the whole Helloween reunion bringing Kai Hansen and Michael Kiske back for a tour? And, you know, I know over the years that I've interviewed the bands and the former members of the band, and there was a little bit of bitterness. But now that that is all gone, you know, what do you think about the reunion?
It's a dream come true. For a long time, it seemed like it would have happened. You know, Kiske had gone on record several times saying, you know, he may forgive those guys, but he hasn't forgotten. And, you know, why would I go back and do Helloween when I have Unisonic? And, you know, you can make some arguments in some respects. Unisonic is a little bit like Helloween, you know, with Kiske singing and Kai on guitar. Kai may not write all the songs, but there's certainly that edge there. But the reunion is just a beautiful thing. It's just amazing that the formation that, you know, no one's leaving, everyone's staying. They're going to be doing, you know, it looks like both he and Kiske and Darius are going to be sharing stage time together, or, you know, Kiske's going to be up there by himself singing some songs, and Darius may be up there by himself. He'll be doing some duets. It's just a beautiful thing. So, yeah, I mean, for longtime Helloween fans like us, it's simply remarkable. And hopefully they'll announce some U.S. dates pretty soon.
Now, talk a little bit about, you included some quotes from Roland in the book. And I thought it was interesting that you did that and you included him and about his beginnings in Helloween, because he came about right when all of this crazy stuff was happening with the lawsuit. And talk about including Roland here.
Yeah, Roland was the interview. The quotes we have from Roland are actually an interview I did with him way back in 2007. So I had saved those, obviously, and not knowing at the time that I'd been writing a book about Noise. But Roland was approached to do the book, but did mention that his recollections of at least Noise, for that matter, were a little bit fuzzy. But, you know, thankfully, I had those quotes. But, you know, Roland came into the band. I mean, imagine having to replace Kai Hansen. What a job that is. And, you know, his band at Hamburg Rampage, where they were good, but they weren't by no means an international band. He was a car mechanic at the time, and Wyke had spotted him playing in a club and said, well, hey, you know, if Kai Hansen never leaves, this is the guy I want. And, you know, Roland walked into a very difficult situation with all the stuff going on between Noise and the band, of course. And, you know, and like you had mentioned, Pink Bubbles, his two songs, at least two of his songs on there, The Chance and Someone's Crying, those are the two best songs on Pink Bubbles, mm-hmm. especially The Chance, which is simply a fantastic song. So, yeah, so Roland had a tough break from the onset, but, you know, he ably filled Kai Hansen's shoes. Roland's a fantastic player. You know, you hear his solos, you know it's his, you know, because he sort of has that neoclassical vibe to him, which Helloween never really had until he joined. Just a great guitar player all around.
Now let's talk about some of the lesser-known bands on a label like, you know, Creator or Coroner. And, you know, they were bands that really weren't big, but they definitely did make their impact on the metal scene and being on Noise Records and got their start there. And, you know, Coroner obviously didn't last that long, but, you know, Creator is obviously still around today. And maybe talk about some of the bands like that.
Yeah, Creator was great because Mila is just a fantastic guy to talk to. And, you know, throughout the book, it's noted that they were one of the hardest working bands on Noise. They released an album almost every year. Carl expected them to go on tour, and sure enough, they did. So, you know, album tour, album tour, album tour. It was quite the relentless cycle. And, you know, a lot of it just stems from Mila's work ethic. You know, I think he was, more than anything else, he just wanted to get out of the coal mining area of Essen, which is, you know, a bit poor. It's either, you know, you work in a coal mine or you work in a coal mine. So, you know, the music was a way for him to get out. And sure enough, you know, they timed it great. You know, Pleasure to Kill, Endless Pain, Terrible Certainty, all those albums are classics. You know, you could make the argument that Creator really didn't become fully developed until Coma of Souls, because if you listen to their stuff now, Coma of Souls is really a jumping off point. for that. But yeah, Crater had it tough. I mean, Carl really worked those guys quite a bit. You know, it was mentioned by a few people in the book that, you know, Carl didn't really respect Crater too much. You know, it was sort of like jump, well, how high, that sort of scenario with Crater. But, you know, Miller never complained. And, you know, once, sort of like Running Wild, once the mid-90s rolled around and noise is standing and the scene was faltering, Miller saw the writing on the wall, and they had the same management with Bogey Kopeck, and they were on over to Gun Records for the rest of the 90s up until Violent Revolution in 2001. But, yeah, Miller is fantastic. I mean, you guys are harder workers than he is. He's so passionate about what he does. You know, their success is certainly deserved today. I mean, they're easily the biggest European thrash band. There is no bigger European thrash band. And I don't even think Carl saw, when Crater was coming up, them becoming this big. And that's all owed to Miller. He's just really worked his tail off, and they deserve all the success they have.
I think the
other one you mentioned was Corner.
Yep.
And like we had mentioned, you know, amazing band, super technical, can play circles around basically anyone. And, you know, Carl saw them sort of as his, he put it, this lost band. But, I mean, they had great critical acclaim, and they came over here to the States a few times and played. They, you know, Tommy Vetterli, of course, is one of the best guitar players in all thrash metal, even metal itself. So, you know, if you think of power trios, it's hard to get more talented than Corner. But, yeah, they never blew up big with while on Noise. They were always sort of this cult band. But, you know, when they reformed and came back around 2010, you know, a lot of people were excited to see them back. So I think their legacy speaks for itself.
Well, one of the best chapters in a book was definitely the chapter about Skyclad, because, you know, there was a lot of stuff that went on with Martin and that band and the label. And, you know, I thought that chapter had a lot of stuff in there that I wasn't expecting to see. And you know, talk about that chapter. And of course, you know, people also don't realize that Sabbath was the thrash band that was like the prequel to Skyclad, but that Martin Walkyr was singing in. And you know, talk about that. Talk about that chapter of the book.
Yeah, well, I guess I could begin with Sabbath. You know, who were British thrash never took off. Of course, you know, you think of Onslaught's the first thing you generally think of. Ventrix, I think, is probably another one as well. Then you have Sabbath, right? I mean, unless I'm missing somebody, but
no.
You know, out of all the British thrash bands, you know, Sabbath was probably, this is at least my opinion, was probably the best. And, you know, because of Andy Sneap is a remarkable guitar player. And Martin Walkyr, I mean, he's sort of this monosyllabic staccato bark. You know, he does that's sort of all his vocal patterns. But you remember all of them. And aside from that, he's simply a remarkable lyricist. You know, the stuff that guy wrote on Dreamweaver is simply remarkable. You know, no other thrash band was, well, at least in the UK for that matter, was writing the lyrics right like that, that were so deep and well thought out.
Right.
Simply a remarkable guy. But, you know, it got to the point where he and Sneap could not see eye to eye on the direction of the band. So, you know, they played this big show in East Berlin in 1990, and on the way back, they broke up. You know, Andy Sneap wanted to write these really long, 10-minute-long songs that were epic, and Martin saw it otherwise. He wanted things to be a little more concise, and, you know, that's what led Martin to leave the band and form Skyclad. But he was always a Jethro Tull fan. And, you know, you can't get much more folk than Jethro Tull. But you know, Martin really can be given a lot of credit for, you know, having the idea to combine folk with metal. I mean, they are the first folk metal band, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think there was one before them. And, you know, the simple fact that they were able to time it perfectly come to turn of the century was simply remarkable. But, you know, there's another one. Martin Walkyr and Carl did not like each other whatsoever. You know, this even goes back to Sabbath, because Sabbath never made any money while on Noise. And Martin sort of held that against Carl, and then, you know, they had to stay with Noise because Martin's contract with Noise didn't expire. And so when they moved over to form Skyclad, they were still on Noise, and that probably explains why they did 5 albums in 5 years. You know, they wanted to get off the label as soon as possible. But, you know, Martin got his final word, and there's a song on Silent Whales of the Lunar Sea, which is called Art Nazi, which is about, you know, Carl Walterbach, his art collection. You know, Carl was Carl was really into collecting art and expensive art for that matter. And so the, you know, the juxtaposition is, of course, here's Carl, the label head who is wealthy enough to own a lot of fine, expensive art, and here are all his bands starving and suffering. And so, Martin certainly took that personally. Yeah, absolutely. But Martin, you know, another great interviewer, great for a soundbite, super nice guy, super intelligent guy. It was really great to talk to him about both Sabbath and Skyclad.
Now, when you talk to Carl, does he have any opinions of what some of these bands are doing today? In other words, you know, the bands that got their start with him on Noise Records, does he keep track of them? You know, has he mentioned anything or mentioned to you his opinion of what they're doing now?
Yeah, somewhat. He knows what's going on for a simple fact. He's still involved with the scene. You know, he knows what all his bands are up to. You know, his opinion on certain bands certainly varies. But, you know, he's expressed to me on many occasions how he's felt about the current incarnation of Helloween or Creator or what Tom G. Warrior is doing now in Trypticon, things like that. Yeah, I mean, Carl certainly keeps tabs on what his bands are doing. You know, he has different opinion on all of them. But, yeah, he still knows what's going on.
Now, did you talk to any some of the more obscure bands, like, say, Midas Touch? You know, they had, like, one album with Noise. Or, you know, let's talk about Scanner. Scanner had a couple records, and that was it with Noise Records. Did you touch on any of those bands, you know, and, you know, did you were you able to, you know, talk to any of the more obscure bands on the label that maybe were there for a very, very short time but, you know, weren't around that long?
Well, the problem that I ran into with the book was, well, how do you write a book about a record company and not include all of its bands? Well, you can't include all of its bands. You know, Carl signed hundreds of bands, and it would simply be impractical to interview and include all of them. Then we'd probably be looking at a 1,000-page book. I don't know if anyone wants to read a 1,000-page book on Noise Records, but nevertheless, that's why we did the Hidden Treasures of Noise Records section, where we took about a dozen or so bands that may not have been as big, but they were important nonetheless. I mean, some of these bands were, like, you think of Death Row, who were really good, who were from Dusseldorf, who are a great thrash band, and you mentioned Midas Touch, who are from Sweden. Sado is a band who gets brought up throughout the book. You know, Sado is short for sadomasochism, of course, and Carl had really high hopes for them. You know, for as much as Carl hated commercial rock or stadium rock, you know, Sado was his one entry into that. Carl had high commercial aspirations for them. Obviously, they did not pan out, but that's how it goes. Scanner were great, of course. Hypertrace is simply a remarkable album. You know, and they're still around today. You know, they were they only released a handful of albums on Noise, and I think they went over the Massacre in the mid-90s, and they're still sticking around today. So yeah, I mean, there are tons of bands. I know there's bands that I left out, and you know, maybe one day we'll do an add-on to the book with these bands. But yeah, I mean, the label has signed hundreds of bands, and some of them, you know, what usually happened with a Noise band who didn't make it, Carl would at least give them two albums to succeed. He never dropped a band after one album. He gave every band at least two chances to make it. And if they didn't make it after that second album, they would have been dropped. And in most cases, as detailed throughout that Hidden Treasure section, they broke up. I mean, in most cases, that's really what happened. But yeah, you know, as the 90s wore on, you know, Carl slowly got settled back into melodic metal. You mentioned Iron Saver was a good one, and Conception is another one we can think of as well, who gave birth to Roy Kahn, of course, who joined Camelot. And then you think of Camelot too, who joined the label in the mid-90s. So yeah, Carl sort of fought against the tide of melodic metal. I think he felt so burnt out by what happened with Helloween that he wanted to try something new. But I mean, most people think of Noise as a melodic metal label, and that's sort of what helped keep the label afloat throughout the rest of the decade of the 90s.
Now, have you talked about or thought about doing a book about another band or maybe even another record label?
Yeah, I have thought about doing one on another label, but I'm not sure if I do have plans to do another book. We are talking to, when I say we, that would be my publisher, Iron Pages, over in Germany. We are talking to a few bands. It will be about a band probably next time. Doing the Noise book was a tremendous amount of work and quite the headache sometimes, and that's just based on the fact that you're dealing with so many people and so many bands and so many stories, and pulling it all together was such a massive workload. And you know, for my first book, I'm very glad and thankful I was able to do it. But I think if I am lucky enough to do another book, it would just be about a band. But, you know, there are some record labels out there, like sort of what we were talking about, that are deserving of their own book. You know, Metal Blade and Century Media and Nuclear Blast. I don't think they've had tumultuous histories, though, as Noise.
Right.
You know, Carl is really the ultimate industry outsider. You know, his bands don't like him, and, you know, he never wanted to be part of the industry to begin with, and that made it perfect for a book about a record company. Now, if that would apply to Metal Blade, or, you know, Brian Slago's always treated his bands very well in Century Media. You know, Robert Compton has done a great job with there, and Nuclear Blast, Marcus Steiger, you know, they may have the same stories. They may not. Maybe there are other stories. They just haven't told anyone about it. But, yeah, I don't know. We'll see. But I think if I will do another book, and hopefully that will be soon, it will be about a band.
Now, do you have any last words, you know, for anybody that's going to be checking out the interview and the book? And, you know, let's talk a little bit about you, David. You know, talk about, I know you write for Dead Rhetoric, and you also, you know, write for Blabbermouth, and talk a bit about yourself, and maybe plug your website as well.
I think I got started after you. I got started around 2001, just writing for smaller magazines, and then I started writing for a site in 2003 called Blistering.com, which was one of the first hard rock / metal websites that spawned in North America. And I think it launched in 1998. And so that's really where I cut my teeth, you know, writing and running a website and learning more about metal. For a little bit, I wrote for Metal Maniac, so I was just a contributor for that, which was great. These days, yeah, like you had mentioned, I have my own site, which is called deadrhetoric.com. Another gentleman, his name's Kyle McGinn, he runs the site on a day-to-day basis, because doing a book and running a website is simply was not happening, and thankfully Kyle was around to take on the reins of the site, and he's done simply a tremendous job. But yeah, on the side, I help out with Blabbermouth. I help Borvash Kurgan with a handful of news stories a week with the site, which is great fun, because Blabbermouth, of course, is one of the best metal websites going. It's one of those sites you can't go a day without visiting. So yeah, it's a great passion of mine. Anyone who writes about metal and gets involved with it, it's really addictive. You know, you want to stay part of the scene. You want to go to shows. You want to talk to bands. You want to meet people. I mean, it's really something you can really become invested in and become truly passionate about it. And if you're lucky enough, you know, you'll be able to spin off and do something like a book or you know, like you, Tony. You know, you've been a writer for a while. You've helped Halloween out. You have your own radio show. So, you know, things like that. It's just a fantastic hobby. It's one of the greatest hobbies in the world, I think.